All right, so welcome to day three. So today I want to cover a little bit more on MPS. So these are the topics I want to talk about today. There will be a little bit about how to gauge matrix product states. Then I want to discuss a little bit a property of matrix product states that is actually very important, namely that they obey an area law. Then I'll talk about how to do truncation on MPS, which is actually numerically very important to do and for many applications. And then last thing I want to discuss today is an application towards real-time evolution of quantum many-body systems. So I probably won't be able to talk about the density matrix renormalization group. So towards the end of the lecture, maybe if there's time, I can quickly review it on my tablet. So then this is where I would need the screen. But yeah, we'll see where how long it will take us to get there. So there's a quick overview of yesterday, what we discussed yesterday for the MPS. So that was towards the end. So what we were and I first essentially just want to give you the review here. So MPS have a very important property, namely that they allow us to efficiently parameterize many-body wave functions. That's what we saw yesterday. So if you have a many-body wave function on n spins, that usually the number of parameters you need to write down that function grows with 2 to the n. So if you have a wave function psi on n spins, then the number of parameters of that wave function, the number of params, grows with the exponential, so n is the number, let me write it below, grows with the exponential of n. That's in general. But for the MPS, for a matrix product state, which is a different type of writing, a different class of wave functions, the number of parameters grows only linearly with n. Right? This is very different. So this means it's, in that sense, it forms an efficient representation of a many-body wave function. And what we saw is that there is this parameter that we call the bond dimension in the MPS. So the bond dimension appears if you look at, an MPS matrix or an MPS tensor. Typically, the vertical legs here have this bond dimension D. And this thing down here is called the physical dimension. This is where, the spins live. And there is a this MPS gives us a systematic way of making that so they introduce some sort of approximation. And what you can do if this is let's say you have a Hilbert space of these n spins, and this is your full Hilbert space, then that Hilbert space is huge. So in MPS, they're sort of lying in a small corner of that Hilbert space, down here, for example. And this could, for example, be an MPS with a bond dimension d equal to 10. Okay? It is a very, very small corner of the full Hilbert space. But what this MPS parameterization gives us is an ability to make this thing, this dot, larger by increasing the size of these matrices. So we can, for example, say, well, I want to do d equal to 100, right? And then the portion of the Hilbert space, of this full exponentially large Hilbert space you could cover, would become a little bit larger. And then you can further increase it, let's say, to 1,000. And then again, comes a little bit larger. Of course, you will never be able to get back the full Hilbert space. You would, in theory, get it by making this bond dimension exponentially large in the number of parameters, right? So this is sort of where we where all the n's are connecting back together. Okay, so that was a a quick review and a overview, some sort of takeaway message, what matrix product states do for us. And now I want to switch a little bit to some more practical things. And one of these things is, so is it okay? Can people, if I start here, they can read it, I guess, right?
Let me just check, because it looks, could you move it slightly to the right? It looks like the camera's a little
slightly to the right. All right. Slightly to the right, like here.
People are saying it's still not visible. You have a smaller board today.
Okay.
That's definitely fine. Yeah.
Okay. Very good.
Keep iterating back and forth.
Yeah, we'll get there. Okay, so the first thing, so one of the things I want to discuss now is so-called gauges, MPS gauges. So we were seeing yesterday, we had a wave function, a matrix product state wave function, that I'm writing down like this. Right, so this is, what this really means is this is like only the tenth, we're representing the core, you know, the coefficients of the wave function in this tensor format. So what gauging of MPSs is a procedure to remove some redundant degrees of freedom. What you see is like there in this representation of the wave function, there's a redundancy. There is like some sort of, some degrees of freedom you can manipulate without actually changing the wave function. And it's very easy to see that if you would go ahead. What you can do is, actually let me break that apart a little bit. So if this is your original MPS, you could just go ahead and insert a resolution of the identity here, right? Where x and x inverse is just a matrix that can be inverted. Any invertible matrix can be put here. And that is the same thing. It doesn't do anything, right? It's just a resolution of the identity. So nothing happened. OK, so this is what people call a gauge degree of freedom. And you can do the same thing on each of these bonds, right? You can do it here, here, here. And if you had a longer MPS, and many more. So there is a lot of degrees of freedom that are, or there's a lot of redundancy in this state. And it turns out that in practice, it's important to control that redundancy. So, and there are ways of doing that. And this is what I want to talk about today. And one way, you know, MPS gauging is a, or fixing, this is what people call fixing the gauge degrees of freedom in an MPS. And the most important gauges I want to, you know, there is essentially, there's different ways of doing that. But the one I want to mention today is so-called left, or the left, right, and the center canonical gauges, right? So there are like three types that I want to discuss here. One is called left canonical, and they're very much related to each other. Right canonical and central canonical gauge. So you might, sometimes people give it slightly different names. I've never been able to like completely nail down all the conventions, but usually it's kind of clear from the context what people mean. So I will usually call them this way. All right, so let's start with the left canonical gauge. So the left canonical gauge is a way, what you do here, left canonical MPS. So what we do here, or it is defined, so what you do is you impose certain constraints on the tensors. So you want to you want to put certain properties on these tensors such that the state itself isn't changed, but the degrees, the number of degrees of freedom that you have, you know, these redundant degrees of freedom get somehow reduced. And one way of doing that is so-called left canonical gauge, and it's in essence, what you do is you impose an orthogonality condition on the tensors. And so this is what people call a left canonical MPS. Okay, so we saw yesterday that these triangles here are isometries. So the condition that these isometries fulfill is that if you do this, then this becomes an identity, okay? So this is what people call a left canonical MPS. And you can do the same thing. So any MPS that you have can always be brought into this form by a sequence of singular value decompositions. That's something that we can all quickly go through over in a moment. Another MPS form that is very closely related is the so-called right canonical. Right canonical gauge. In which case you now have opposite triangles. like this. And again, you know, they are they follow the same condition. So that if you would connect them this way, you know, you connect this guy with its complex conjugate. So this is this here. If you would call this U, then this would be U dagger, right? This is U, and this would be U dagger. So then, and they follow the same condition. The important point is these matrices are not the same, right? So this is a different one. I want to, like, you know, maybe fill them out here with some, give them some more information, because they're not the same matrices, right? So this could be a single state. So you would have one single state, psi, and you can represent it in these different ways. And then there is the central canonical gauge. I think I'll be able to squeeze that in here. The central canonical gauge is essentially a concatenation of the left and the right. In this case, you'll have a tensor, an MPS that has this form. So it took like 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, let's have 4. Okay, so this is the central canonical gauge. Now what you have is, and I'll even make this here, I'll give this some sort of a different color. So what you have here is all these tensors here are left orthogonal, so they follow, if you would, you know, you have to write it actually. So it, if this tensor, so the left orthogonal tensors have this property. It's just another way of drawing this diagram above there, right? Which means it's the identity. So these are these guys. Then this guy here has this other property, which if I take this one with its complex conjugate, then this is also an identity. And this here in the middle, that doesn't do anything. Has no property, like any of these properties. And this is what people call a central canonical gauge. So that's pretty much what I wanted to say here. So there is an algorithm of bringing any MPS into that form, which is by a sequence of singular value decompositions. Yes?
I'm just curious. I'm looking at the tensor network documentation page, and they talk about stuff like orthogonality center. Is that related
yes.
to this? Or?
Yeah, so this is what people call this here. So this it would be called the orthogonality center. Orthogonality center. Because everything left, these tensors are called left orthogonal. These are called right orthogonal. And that is the center where the orthogonality changes. So it goes from left to right as you cross this bond, it's across this site. So this is what people say is the orthogonality center. And this is, so these are like three types of gauges that people use in practice in their calculations, because what we'll see in a moment is they will, some computations considerably simplify if you go into these types of gauges. Okay, any questions? No. So there is a way of doing, of bringing an MPS into that form. I'm not going to discuss it. It's a sequence of singular value decompositions. We can this, if you know, if you want, maybe you can, we can discuss this after the lecture. So why would we even care about this type of thing? I just want to give you a quick example of how to, you know, we were yesterday towards the end of the lecture, I told you how to compute expectation values, right? So we go again, expectation value 2. So what we want to compute is psi O psi. And now we'll say this operator O is a local operator that lives at site 2 of an MPS, of a lattice, of a one-dimensional lattice. So let's say this is site 1, 2, 3, and 4. So the MPS lives here. So this means, so how does that, so we're given an MPS psi, and we want to compute some expectation value of some operator, which can be represented as a matrix in whatever basis we're using here. So this is this diagram. right? So usually what you need to do to compute it is, I explained that yesterday, you start contracting that network. You go from the start, for example, from here, right? You contract those two guys and you end up with this. Then you decide to contract this guy in, you get this. And you do the top thing. So each of this is each operation I'm showing you is a binary contraction, and you do the same thing from the right hand side. Right, so now we had, I forgot to count, but already a few. So then you go like this. In the next step, you may go like this. May not be optimal, but you know, we don't care. And then you go like this. And then you go like this. And oh, finally. Ooh, that was a long journey. So we're done. Well, it was took us some effort. So what would happen, and a simplification of this, this thing will significantly simplify if you represent your state in this canonical gauge, right? And I'm going to quickly show you how that looks like. So we'll erase that again. I just like want to use my hands because it's much better to like the much cleaner after. So all right, so we'll redo this whole thing, but now instead of using, you know, that were just like MPS that had no conditions on its tensors, we're going to use now one that is in the central canonical gauge. Okay, and there is no tensor here. Sorry, no lag here. So okay, so in this case, the diagram looks like that, okay? I'm just like inserting the definition here, like inserting the MPS. So, and what's happening now is that because we were choosing these matrices to have that property, you know, this will just simplify, it will become a line. Yes?
If we take the complex conjugate of psi, wouldn't the direction of the triangle change, or it would be the same?
So it is sort of changing, right? So this is here at the top. I'll draw it a little bit larger. I have this. And here at the bottom, it's not changing this direction. It's changing this direction, right? So here it looks like that, right? So those two guys were flipped, right? So here you had, this was, I don't know if you call this leg one and this leg two. And down here, this is leg one and this is leg two, right? It was sort of flipped over. Okay, you apply, and you know, this is this thing. Now you apply the same procedure on the right-hand side. I can just erase that because it is just a straight line. And then, ooh, I can also erase that. That's nice, right? Okay, there you go. Oh, okay, so that was much simpler. So now I only have to do like two contractions, right? I go ahead and be like, all right, now I'll contract this thing. And now I'll go and contract this thing, right? And then I'm done. So that was much simpler. So this is why people in practice use, this is one very simple application of the central canonical gauge. But it is important to use it, not only because, and the reason why it's important to use it is, oh, let me actually write this down. So there's two reasons, or like multiple reasons, but one reason I want to mention is it simplifies, so there's a simplification of contraction. So that's one reason why you want to use that. And another reason is stability of algorithms. Stability of optimization. And that's a much more complex topic that I'm not going to cover today, or in the lectures at all. But it turns out that if you do some optimizations of these tensor networks, it is usually very important to reduce the number of redundant degrees of freedom. So that's just, it turns out that in many cases, that's the difference between being able to get a very accurate result and being able to getting a very poor result. So you may not be able to get good results without taking care of that thing in many cases. So you really should, you know, always think about how to incorporate these types of, you know, something like that into a tensor network. In many cases, so for MPS, you can do that. There are other tensor networks where it's not possible to define such types of, you know, nice gauges where things cancel out. Or then more recently, people have understood how to do it for 2D networks, but then you impose additional constraints onto your, you know, it comes with constraints. So it's an active, actually, research topic, how to use such gauges or, you know, tensors with such degrees, so with such properties in more complex optimization algorithms in two dimensions, for example, and higher. But in one dimension, it is very well understood, and I think it's also very important to consider that. Okay, questions? Let's move that up. So I'll go all the way up. Down. So, rear. Is that the rear? Yeah, okay. Yes. What is... Oh, yeah, what's the question?
So the first one you drew without the gauge constraint, so just the circles.
Yeah.
And then you can transform it into having the gauge constraints. Is there a trade-off between, like, say you have some general state psi, like how much time you save doing the contractions, like the simplification of the contractions, versus doing the SVDs to like get it into the gauge form?
I mean, of course you have to pay. So if this is a thing you only do once, then you might not want to do the SVD, because if you want to, so if, you know, all in life you want to do is do this like one single contraction, then no, you don't have to worry about going into this gauge. But what you often need to do, so many of these algorithms work in a way that they iteratively go and optimize the first tensor, then you go and optimize the second while keeping the other ones fixed, and third, and so on. And during the process of moving around and, you know, optimizing every tensor after the other, you have to sort of do transformations anyway. And in that case, it definitely pays off. In particular, I think, I mean, it pays off from the point of, you will end up with a, you know, you have the state and some central gauge according to one side, and now you are, okay, I do some optimization there and I move to the next side. I'll just do the update. If you want to compute something there, you can just very quickly do it. It's more of a convenience thing. But the more important point is really the stability. So this is why I think you should worry about that much more. But there are definitely cases where, you know, you want to... So there is another gauge that I haven't mentioned, which is called the... it's confusing. It's it was called the canonical gauge or gamma lambda gauge that Giffre Vidal invented. So he was the one who used that a lot. It's a very convenient gauge. And in this case, you can sort of have like... It's a way of bringing a state into the form where you can either have the left or the right orthogonality center, depending on how you choose it. And that is, for certain applications, very useful. Yes?
So for types of gauges, you now said, right, left, right, center. But at the same time, we have this, you know, physical motivation of having a wave function. So do people also talk about literally U1 gauge, SU1 gauge, stuff like this? Or is
so it is, this is, it is not... So there is no, I mean, at this point, I would say it's like a different thing, right? Mm-hmm. But there are sort of connections between these gauges and, you know, other types of gauges on, I think, on a mathematical, there's a mathematical foundation. But I would say there, I wouldn't actually, like, I don't want to say that there is, I don't know enough about it, first of all, to, like, really say anything concrete here. And then second, I would just consider that as a independent topic for this part of. Okay, so one thing I want to mention here, and then I'll actually do that over here, is this is front. Actually it here. One thing I want to mention is we were looking at like expectation values of one local operator. We can also look at correlation functions. And I just want to like mention here a property of MPS for correlation functions. So correlation functions are observables that have we live, you know, where we try to measure something like this, where operators I and j here are now living at different sites of the lattice. So you have a lattice, and you have I and j, and you have an operator O here, OI, an operator OJ here, and you want to measure the expectation value of this thing. And it turns out that...
I'm sorry, are you able, I mean, just moving forward, are you able to shift just a little? I think we somehow forgot to
move
the line.
oh, you're right. Okay, let me actually move that. Oh, sorry about that. I was actually, that was my reference point, but this one is the one, yeah.
Yeah, I know, sorry.
All right, correlation of functions. We'll just have to stay longer. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So we want to measure these correlation functions. And MPS, as it turns out, so typically, you know, if you have a ground state of some system, there are many of these correlation functions as a function of the distance between I and J can behave in different ways, right? Typically, so for example, what you will see in systems that have some are like critical, you will see that this may decay as something like, you know, I minus J, something like this. A 1 over, you know, it's a power law decay where you have an exponent of 1. So, you know, it looks something like this. If you go here, the expectation value of OI OJ, and here we plot I minus J. So as it turns out, so this is the generic, you know, it could happen. This is some you know, critical system, some critical system psi, or some critical state psi. As it turns out, it's with an MPS. If you take psi to be an MPS, so then it turns out the only thing you will ever be able to represent are exponentially decaying correlations. So this will go something like the exponential of I minus J, and there will be some sort of length scale. Oh, sorry. This is tau is some sort of lambda involved, right? So this is a very fundamental, this is baked into the ansatz. So an MPS will only ever be able, with an MPS, MPS correlations, will only ever be able, so MPS will only ever be able to represent exponentially decaying correlations. And that is a limitation of a matrix product state. Because in condensed matter physics, if you are at a phase transition, for example, in many systems, these correlations do just not decay exponentially. They decay in a different way. You will be able to represent this power law, for example, over some length scales. So for the MPS, so essentially, an MPS can represent. It's very good at modeling like sums of exponentials. So you'll be able to sort of, if this is on a log-log plot, right? Log and log, so this will become a straight line. Some straight line on a log-log plot. If you go and plot this here, if you plot this for the MPS and log of OI OJ, what you'll see is, oh, maybe it goes like for a little while, and then whoop, it will just bend and go down. In fact, I should actually say what I mean here are, I don't know how to represent that, the connected correlators, right? So this is actually, you know, let me put here, say connected. So connected means that you look at OI OJ minus OI OJ. Okay, so these are the connected correlation functions. so this is what I mean here when I put this in. Okay, very good. So very quickly, let's. One thing I wanted to discuss now. Any questions about this?
Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Is there any intuition by why you can only represent exponential correlations?
Yes, there is. So, and I mean, the intuition is the following. Let's actually look at something like, you know, let's try to look at operator OI here. And then we go over many, many sites. And then we're like, here is OJ, right? And now you go ahead. And so assume we were able to, you know, reduce everything on the left-hand side because we were using orthogonality from the left-hand side. Now here we cannot use that because there is an insertion here, right? So we'll have to actually contract that thing. And we do here the same thing on the right-hand side. So now we have, you know, many of these tensors in between. Let's assume for the sake of the argument that they're all identical, right? You could say, well, this is an infinite system, bulk, and we're in the bulk of a very large system, for example, then they are all identical. So what I'll do is I'll just write this as this. To the power of I minus J, okay? So I have just, I take this guy and raise it to the power of how many times I have to put it here, right? So this is what people call the transfer operator. So if the state is properly normalized and has some other features or has some, you know, so for certain states, for most of the states, it turns out that there is one eigenvalue of this guy, which is 1, and then there is a bunch of other ones which are smaller than 1 or somewhere in the complex plane. And it turns out, so the point is that what you're doing here, right, so you can view this as a linear operator where we have some input vector here on the right-hand side, and then you apply that operator a bunch of times, I minus J times, all over again. And then you compute the overlap with this guy. So what's happening is that that operator has a spectrum. There is one eigenvalue with that has modulus 1. And then there is a bunch of other with smaller modulus. And what you'll see is that, so these are the left and right. So it's not Hermitian. So it's not a Hermitian operator, but it has left and right eigenvectors. So you can expand it in some sort. There is like a spectral decomposition of this guy as well. So what you'll see is if you apply, so on this operator can be represented in the basis of the left eigenvectors of this guy, or sorry, right ones, I think. Anyway, you can like one the left or the right, you'll be able to expand it in that basis. And then you can apply this operator. You can think in that case, this is if you would have diagonalized this guy. And then you keep on applying, what you'll see is that you will just different the eigenstates will acquire different phases. There will be one, will just the one to the, so this has an expansion, right, in states. So you can write this as some sort of state L that is some sort, you know, some coefficient A I times some basis I. And where I goes from 1 to d squared in this case, because it's d by d. And the largest, let's assume they're ordered. So I equal to 1 would be the eigenstate that has this modulus. And then I equal to 2, you would have, so let's call this is, so this, so it has I equal to 1 has a lambda 1 equal to 1. Then you have I equal to 2 has a lambda 2, which is smaller than 1. And then all the other ones are, there's like many more that are all smaller than 1. So what you'll do is now you can expand that operator into spaces and you'll see, well, the one that has, there is some overlap with the biggest one and that will just like keep coming. So this is the thing you have to subtract at the end of the day. But then there are smaller ones that will just be, every time you apply that operator, you'll get that state reduced by a factor of lambda 2, right? So you'll just get like lambda 2 by lambda 2 by lambda 2 by lambda 2, and a similar thing for lambda 3. So they all get multiplied over and over again. And what you'll see, that is where this algebraic decay, where this exponential decay comes from, because you are multiplying the same operator all over again. All the eigenvalues are within the unit circle, so they will just like exponentially collapse.
Okay, yeah.
All right. Very good. So I'll remove that and move to a topic which is very quickly MPS, follow an area law, or have an area law baked in. Yeah.
When you say applied over and over again, just rough order of magnitude, how?
So the num it so how I minus j times, right?
Yeah.
So you had that operator. You have then one insertion at side I and one insertion at side j, and then that thing in the middle, so this operator, you have to apply it I minus j times I minus j.
Okay.
Because you took that operator here, so you took this thing on the left-hand side, and then you had I minus j repetitions of this guy. I was assuming translational invariant, so they were all the same. So you had I minus j of these insertions here, and then on the other side you had this thing again.
So the condensed matter application, it is like n squared. So.
Hmm?
For a condensed matter application, I'm just trying to get a picture for how big these diagrams are, and that would be something like n squared.
So this is for like a one-dimensional system. So you have a system of spins, right? That are, for example, you could have an Ising model in 1D. That, and you look at the ground state of the Ising model in 1D. So that's what you want to find. There's a phase transition point at the critical magnetic field. You will get the ground state there. It will have like critical properties. And then you take the MPS approximation of this thing. So you'll try to approximate it. And then you'll compute the correlation function. For example, this could be, I don't know, let's say Sx here. And Sx here. So this is j and this is I. And you do it, there are ways to get infinitely large MPSs. You do that, you get the approximation to the ground state, and then you compute the correlation function. So what you need to do is you have to insert, an S here, an S here, and then in between, there will just be like many, many of identical insertions of this thing, right? Many, many, many. They're all identical because they're the same thing, right? It's like the translational invariant MPS. So I'm not replacing anything. I'm just rewriting it as this to the power of I minus j. I mean, it's just like the number of sites, the difference between the number of sites that are in between I and j. There may be plus minus one, I don't know, depending on how you count. That is what I'm doing, and now I'm looking at the spectrum of this operator here that has been raised to the power of I minus j. If you would view this, you can view this as a matrix, right? If you would connect these guys together into a single tensor, a single index, and then the same here, then this suddenly becomes a linear map, right? You take a vector, multiply it by a matrix, and then take the overlap of the result with another vector. So here is a matrix. And that matrix is non-Hermitian, but you can diagonalize it. It has left and right eigenvalues, and it has a spectrum. And this spectrum has the property that it's like within the unit circle. So there is like one eigenvalue 1, and there's other ones. And that are smaller than 1, have a modulus smaller than 1. And if you raise this to the power, so every time you multiply, you raise this to one additional power, the spectrum will become smaller and smaller, it will shrink. There is one single one that will just remain let's assume there is one single one. That will remain because it's 1. And this is why you have to look at the connected part here. But let's not worry about that. So that one that is there, that doesn't change the argument. But then all the other ones decay exponentially. Every time you apply I minus j, each one of them gets smaller by a factor, like by its own factor. You do something like you have lambda I to the power, so lambda n to the power of I minus j. And they just like decay, it's like exponential decay. And that exponential decay of that as a function of repeated applications is what you will at the end of the day see here. This is why this correlation function will always decay exponentially.
And then the connected part, as you say, takes...
The connected, yeah, yes.
That doesn't.
Exactly. And the connected part essentially takes care of the fact that there is one eigenvalue, which is 1, and, it's a little bit... But that doesn't change any... It doesn't qualitatively change anything, right? This, like, thing. All right. Is that clear? Okay. Very good. So I'll leave it here. So then let's go here. So MPS area law, very quickly, so the point here is that MPS have an area law baked in, And that's what I want to like quickly highlight here. It means that there are some, you know, we were hearing earlier, I was telling you that one-dimensional systems, ground states of one-dimensional gapped systems, local gapped, one-dimensional local gapped Hamiltonians have an area law, okay? Which means they are, if you take reduced density matrices of a very large state and look at reduced density matrices of a small region, you'll see that the entanglement will be upper bounded. And as you go, make the region larger and larger, you will not get more entanglement. And that is what an MPS also has. It has exactly that property. So let's quickly illustrate how that looks like. So we'll start with an MPS in the right, already in the canonical gauge, right? Something like this. In fact, we'll use the central canonical gauge, like this. And you know, let's assume it's just very large. Okay, very large state. And what we'll do now, this is psi, and now we'll compute psi psi, the reduced density matrix. Okay, so I'll actually make it a little bit shorter. Let's say psi psi, so the reduced density matrix is this. And then I have another thing on top here, which looks like that. And so on and so forth. Does it make sense? Is anyone like confused by this diagram or? All right, if not, then we'll go ahead. So what we'll do now is we'll say, all right, let me call this here. So you should have been confused. There's something missing. So there is A, this is region A, and this is region B. Okay, so we'll divide this into two regions. What we're going to do now, we'll compute rho A, which is the trace over region B of rho, right? We're calling this here rho, the reduced density matrix. Sorry, the density matrix of the ground state. So we'll trace out this part on the right-hand side here. And I'll just do that on this diagram. So we'll have many, many here, right? Yes?
Oh, why are we saying this is of the ground state?
Because we're considering, what we're doing is we're considering ground states of one-dimensional gapped. So, sorry, it doesn't have to be the ground state. Sorry, you're right. It could be any state. Let's actually say it's not the ground state. It's just some quantum state. You're right. But at the end of the day, what matters is that we'll be interested in ground states in general, but it could be any state. Okay. That's correct. Thanks for pointing that out. So what we'll do now is, you know, let's say there's a bunch of sites here. I don't want to draw them all, but we'll start somewhere at the boundary and use the same argument that we did before. We'll trace out B. So tracing out B, if this is like the first site, right? So here we had the first site. So tracing out the first degree of freedom means I'm connecting these guys, okay? So this means, I'll just like draw it in a little bit of different, better way. It means I'm doing this, right? And this I'll replace with this because we can do so because of the gauge. And then we can just repeat that whole procedure. Now this will just like everything here will collapse. It will just become a single line. Okay, it will look like that. So that's the reduced density matrix for region A. Now we can just rearrange that a little bit into this way. You know what we'll see, and this here. So now it becomes a little bit tricky. So I'll just write it like this. So I have a tensor here and a tensor here. All right, I'll just write it out like this. And then here I have the same thing. So something like this. Okay, we'll just like bring all the legs up to the top here. And then there might be more, okay? But what you see is that this is a diagonal matrix. Sorry, let's actually try the following. I have to apologize. One thing I didn't say, I was actually implicitly using a different representation, right? I was telling you before the canonical gauge had this thing in the middle. All right, so we can just keep it that way. Let's say it looks like that. And then in any case, we can, you know, we can contract this into like one large matrix, one single matrix. And then we'll end up with this here, okay? Now that matrix we can also, you know, diagonalize. So this is, in this case, a Hermitian matrix. So we can diagonalize it and, you know, write it in this way. Where now this thing here is diagonal, right? It's diagonal. Bigger than zero is the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix, right? There you go. So these are the eigenvalues of the reduced density matrix. So how many are there? Who knows? How many values do we have here? How large is the bond dimension here? Or in other words, how large is the bond dimension here? Any guesses? We were like, if we call the MPS bond dimension d by d by small d, so these were already MPS bond dimensions, then how large would this be? It's d, capital D, right? So the bond dimension here is capital D. We're using an MPS with a fixed bond dimension. And so this means that what you have here is essentially, a, you know, it looks something like V dagger times some diagonal matrix lambda times V, okay? And here you will have D eigenvalues. So how does, what is the entanglement entropy of such a row? Okay, so what is S of row A? Who remembers? It was the trace of row A log row A, okay? Log 2 of row A. And that is nothing else than the sum over, let me call them lambda here, let's call in lambda I, times the log of 1 over lambda I. I goes from 1 to d, okay? So, and I notice now that my notation might not have been optimal, but let's keep lambda for now for the eigenvalue of the reduced density matrix. So that is the entanglement entropy. And what is the upper bound of this entanglement? How large can it be at most? When is the upper bound realized of that matrix? So which values of lambda would you think is the upper bound realized? So you're free now to choose. You have D values, right? Now you're free to choose these values. You do whatever you want. What is the upper, how large can you make this S? Any guess? Or let me put it that way. For V, how would these lambdas, this is, you know, this probability distribution have to look like such that this becomes maximal? Flat, yes. They have to be all identical. It's like the uniform distribution, right? Has the maximum entropy. So then it follows, you plug that in, right? You have each lambda I is 1 over D, okay? So if that's the case, you can plug this in. You will get a sum over I that goes from 1 over D. So now they're all the same, right? Lambda I is 1 over D. So we'll just pull that out. This is also the same. So it's the log of D. So it's like D times the log of D divided by D. So we'll just remove that. And we get log D, okay? So what we know, that this, we know that the entanglement entropy of that region will always be bounded by log of the bond dimension. So if you choose the bond dimension you already of your MPS to be D, you already made the implicit assumption, or not assumption, you made the implicit constraint that the entanglement of the MPS, that any subregion of that MPS can have with the rest, is upper bounded by log of D. Okay. Now, you know, you can just rephrase that a little bit. You know, we can also, is this the mid? No, this is the real. Okay, so we can do the following from that, right? So we have S of row A is smaller equal log D. And that is, you know, if we rephrase that a little bit, we get E to the S is smaller equal to D. Okay, it's just like, actually it's the log 2, so we'll have log, you know, 2 to the S, but it's, you know, it's, I don't know, we log two, log ln, who cares? All the same. What you see is that if the entanglement, if you have a system that for some reason the entanglement, as you make the system larger, wants to grow linearly, for example, well, then you better make the bond dimension grow exponentially, because otherwise you'll not be able to represent that type of entanglement. Okay. So whenever you see, if you have a system, an MPS represented as an MPS, and that will, some, for example, happen during time evolution, you look at the MPS. You do something to it, and we'll come to that. I just want to give you an example. If you do time evolution with an MPS, what you will typically see is you take a very large MPS, you do something, you take the ground state of a Hamiltonian, you quench the Hamiltonian in such a way that the state is no longer the ground state. You let it evolve forward in time. There are ways of doing that approximately with an MPS. What you'll see is that if you look at a finite region of that very large state, and you look at the reduced density matrix, or you look at the entanglement, S, of that small region with the rest, you will see it grows linearly. It grows and grows and grows and grows, right? And there will be, it will be a saturation at some point that depends on how large the system is. But in general, because of that linear growth, you would need the bond dimension has to grow exponentially. Because of that, so this means that it's like classically not feasible with for that reason to do time evolution with MPS. But we'll come back to that, I think, in more detail during the during the tutorial. So we'll be able to explore that there. Okay, so the main point is like MPS follow an area law, and they can only represent states with a bounded entanglement. That's their limitation. They can't do more. Okay, so that's it. Let's move to truncation. So I'll move this up. The rear goes up. So then this comes down. So I will not use the very back. Okay, I'll just destroy the sponge. Okay. let me quickly produce some dust here. Okay. So truncation. So that's one of the things that is practically important, truncation of MPS. Sorry?
The line, sorry.
The line. Thank you. Thanks. There you go. Truncation of MPS. So what I want to discuss here is the following scenario. You're given an MPS with a very large bond dimension, and you would like, or with some large bond dimension, that you are not able to, you know, you want to reduce the cost of that. You want to reduce the bond dimension of that cost because for some reason you need to make it, you know, you cannot afford to store such a large state. And the task is the following. The task is given some state with some bond dimension d tilde. You want to reduce this. You want to find another state that has a bond dimension d, right? Where this is psi tilde, this is psi, and this should be, you know, roughly, this is an approximation. And you want to do it in such a way that the norm of psi tilde minus psi is, you want to minimize that essentially, right? Minimize that overall psi. Okay, so this is what people think when they talk about truncation. That's what they want to do. So you want to find the psi with the bond dimension, with a fixed bond dimension d. So you fix d, so this is d tilde. And you want to find the closest state to this d tilde, the large bond dimension, such that, you know, they're closest. And this is the two norm here. And the strategy that one can use here is a so-called iterative. So there's many ways of doing that. One is iterative. So if you would find the real, like the closest one, then this is what you call optimal, right? This would be the optimal state if you would find the minimum. And there are ways of sort of doing that approximately or trying to optimize in such a way. But I'm not going to discuss that. So what I'm going to discuss is just a strategy which is iterative SVD, okay? You can just use a singular value decomposition to achieve that. And the way you do that is, first, we'll assume that that state here, psi tilde, was already brought into the right canonical gauge, right? And I haven't explained how to do that, but I'll just assume that someone has done it for you. So this is the state psi. So let's call it, psi tilde. And what we'll do now is we'll use singular value decompositions, one, you know, iteratively to like reduce the bond dimension. So this has d tilde, this has d tilde, this has d tilde. So the second step, we'll take this matrix here and do an SVD on it. So we can, you know, write this. Let's actually, for the sake of simplicity, assume that it's in the central canonical gauge where we have this thing here on this side. So what we'll do is we'll use an SVD. Singular value decomposition to write it in this way. Okay, so that was a singular value decomposition of this matrix. Okay, that gave us this thing here. And you know, there might be, actually I have to write it this way, there might be some matrix S, and then there will be here some unitary matrix. Okay, so this was the singular value decomposition of that matrix. So because this was d tilde, you know, we know that this, let's call this s tilde. So s tilde has roughly, and you know, there are some details here I don't want to discuss, but let's assume it has d singular values, d tilde singular values. That's what you usually get if you have a one dimension d tilde. You do this SVD, there will be d tilde singular values. Now we do truncation. That's step three. Truncate. What type of truncation is what? This is what we were discussing, like I think yesterday. We truncate away some singular values. So this S here will look something like this. There will be an S1 tilde, an S2 tilde, all the way down to some S tilde D tilde, okay? Where this thing here will have some, so the sum of the squares will be 1, okay? So we know that the sum over Si tilde squared will be 1 because it's a normalized state. But other than that, we don't really know anything concrete about them, except that hopefully they will decay, right? So that is the hope. So here we have I, and here we have Si tilde. So they will decay some way. And let's say here is our value of D that we want to keep. So what we do is we'll just say, all right, let's just throw out all of them. We go only to D. And then we'll set all of those to 0, okay? So we set them to 0, so now we're like, all right, we don't have actually to keep those zeros. We just cut the size of the matrix. You know, you make the bond dimension here a little bit smaller. So let me actually say first it was thick, right? So what we're doing now is we're making it thin because we're just throwing away a few columns of that matrix. And we can do the same on this matrix here. This is USV. So we reduce the size, and then we're done. So now we have a new matrix S here. So this is S tilde, V tilde. So U tilde, S tilde, V tilde. So here we have U, S, and V. And then, again, you know, everything else is to the right. So now we take this guy and multiply it into here, and we'll end up with the following state. So we'll have this thing here. All right, where now this is D, and this is D tilde, and this is d tilde. And now we just repeat that procedure over and over again. So I'm not going to describe that because it's like, I think you'll be able to do that yourself. But this is what, this is a practical way to do truncation. Now, is this optimal? It's not, right? But it's very close. So usually there are, what you can do is you can take that state and take this to this decompression, and then take this as an input to some other optimization scheme that will lower it a little bit, and then you will most likely get the real optimum. But for most practical purposes, it is more than sufficient. Yes?
So the idea of truncation is literally like if I were considering a thermal state, some sort of Boltzmann distribution, and the energy eigenvalues, and I throw away
Yes, yes, exactly. So this is really, so this is the picture if you would go to the reduced density matrix. So you can, so what I describe, you're throwing away singular values, right? The squares of the singular values are the eigenvalues of the reduced density, right? So these singular values here, the squares of those, if you would consider, for example, the reduced density matrix on only that side here, where you trace out everything else, then the eigenvalues would be the squares of that matrix. And truncation is exactly what you just said. You have some sort of a distribution, and you're throwing away the small values of that distribution. Okay.
Just another question.
Yes.
Is there a rule of thumb, like usually how much that we throw away, or is there like a criteria for that?
You can keep track of that. You can find upper bounds. Okay, let me not find it. So there are ways to, because you always know what you are throwing away. So if you do one round of these truncations, then one second, where did that go? Then you can keep track of all the things that you have been throwing away. I don't know. Where did I move that? Interesting. So I think there is a bound. So I forgot now the bound. I think the bound is that if you look at the norm of psi tilde minus psi, right, then that is something like smaller like 2 times the sum over all the truncated weights over all the sites, right, where n goes from 1 to n. And then there will be some truncated weight per site I, and that is the truncated weight per, let me call this epsilon I, and epsilon I is, you know, the sum over this I think it's the square root, I forget, there may be square roots here, but there is an upper bound, and where this is this something like the sum over all discarded eigenvalues, right, where this goes from d plus 1 to d tilde as I squared, something like that. I had it somewhere here, but I think I just erased it. So yeah, it's gone. But there is an upper bound. So you can find, you know, there is an upper bound. And what people typically do in a practical simulation is that they go for, you know, a practical simulation may look like this. I have a state, I apply something, then I have to truncate. You keep track of what you just truncated. And then you accumulate whatever you're truncating, you keep on accumulating it. And that will give you over the course of your algorithm, like as time progresses that you run your algorithm, you will see, well, my truncated weight is small, right? Very, very small. And I will just keep on growing, and it will keep on growing, and will keep on growing. And depending on what you do, it may not grow very slow, may not grow at all, or it may grow only a little bit, or it may grow exponentially, right? It really depends on what you do. But there is a way of keeping track of that. And then you will say at some point, well, now my truncated weight is 10 to the minus 4 or something like that. And then you say, all right, I think I can no longer trust my results. And then you usually stop.
You mentioned relating this to the density matrix of your state. Does that give you any information of how these singular values decay?
Sorry, say again.
Do you have any information on how these singular values typically decay? Does it usually?
Yeah, so we were discussing that yesterday. I'm not aware. I don't know if there's any like fundamental theorem that tells you how they have to decay, but they usually decay depending on what type of system you have. I think they can decay exponentially, or they may decay in a different way. They may, but ground states typically show, like of gap systems, a very rapid decay, which is why you can approximate them very well.
Yeah.
Other systems may have different behaviors of these. So it really depends on how you set up the system. You can, for example, try to do two-dimensional systems with a one-dimensional geometry, and then it looks completely different again. Yeah.
So last time when we discussed truncation of wave function, we did something similar where we neglected smaller spectral values. How
yes.
is this different from that?
It is the same.
But
it is exactly the same procedure. It is just now, like before that, I was not in the context of a tensor network or of a matrix product state. It was just a general way of like truncating a wave function. And also, I also introduced that. There was also like a connection with the Schmidt decomposition, and it's just the same procedure, applied in the context of a tensor network. The point is, like, if you only do a single truncation, the one that I was discussing last time, then we can say this is an optimal truncation in the Frobenius norm sense, where we had, you know, the Frobenius norm is the thing we want to minimize. Then it becomes optimal. If you do a single truncation, that's the case. But if you do this like sequential stuff here, then that's no longer the case. It's just in that case, you know, some truncations might depend on each other. So it could be you go ahead and you want to truncate something here, but you know, the optimal truncation here might depend on what you actually were truncating over here. You know, there could be some sort of dependence of truncations that it's a little bit more complicated than that. In practice, I have to say, it rarely matters. Yeah, so I was actually hoping we can go ahead and discuss time evolution, but I think we'll probably stop here and do that maybe tomorrow or this afternoon. I think we'll also tomorrow afternoon is the tutorial. So we can discuss that tomorrow.